just a minute of background why I thought about this subject. To me, there's an odd outlook that I come across often enough, that the natural condition, I think, is to be lying in bed. Anything else needs an explanation. You got up and walked around? Why? Why did you do that? Why did you just stay in bed? God, too. Why did God do anything? If he's perfect and self-controlled, self-sufficient, and independent, why did he do anything? I find this presupposition, this sort of starting position, I have no natural sympathy for it. Couldn't you ask a person who's lying in bed, how come you're just lying in bed? Why aren't you doing something? You know, there are lots and lots of things to do. How come you're just lying there doing nothing? And with respect to God, if he wasn't doing anything, you could say, you have infinite power and you have infinite ability. Why aren't you using it to do something? I don't think one position is a more preferred position than the other position. Okay, there are philosophies that say you need more of a reason to act than to be passive. More of. But I don't think you need zero reason to be passive. Some certain crimes are passive crimes. I'm just out of sympathy with the whole thing. And I come across it very often. So, that's a great idea. So, I decided to look at some Jewish sources that are related to the general idea. The first one that I want to discuss is a famous statement in the Talmud that a person who learns Torah and does mitzvos, different yesos, shelo lishma, without pure motivation, not just to serve God, will eventually come to do it lishma. He'll eventually come to serve God, do mitzvos, study Torah, with a pure motivation. So here's the picture. Here's a guy who's studying Torah for money, for honor, for respect, for love, whatever it is. And that's his sole reason for studying it. He's doing it shelo lishma, not for his own sake. And the Talmud says that if a person will study Torah and perform mitzvahs like that, then eventually he will outgrow his need for this selfish motivation, and he will come to do it for its own sake. That's what it says. And it bothered me for decades. I used to tell students, that's what it says in the Talmud, so it's got to be right, but I don't get it. I don't see why it's right. And two things bother me. First of all, it seems that there are clear counterexamples. There are professors of Talmud who study Talmud and teach Talmud and who are not religious at all. And they do this for their whole lives. And they die that way. And they never graduate. They're studying it for money, keep a job, certain amount of prestige. Cheap prestige. Because as a professor, you can get it without understanding. And the principle just doesn't seem to work. That was one thing that bothered me. The other thing that bothered me is, logically, why should it be so? If a person is doing something to get a benefit, so he sees what he's doing as the key to getting that benefit, and he does it for a year, for 5 years, for 10 years, wouldn't he become more and more dependent on the benefit? Wouldn't the achievement of the benefit become more and more habitual, more and more ingrained? Why should I think the person is doing something for a payoff, and he gets the payoff, he gets it, regularly gets it, eventually he'll lose interest in the payoff and do it for some other reason? Why would I dream of such a thing? Doesn't seem to be consistent with what we know about human nature. So this, as I say, this bothered me for a long time. Now, a number of years ago, someone acquainted me with what Rabbi Shlomo Salanter says about this. Shosalanta says that this idea of studying Torah, or doing the mitzvah, Shelo lishma, for a selfish motivation. And the Gemara promises you'll graduate to do it for its own sake, has a condition built in. And the condition built in is that you have to want to do it for its own sake. There has to be a goal. If you don't have that goal, if you don't at least want to do it for its own sake, then the Talmud statement doesn't apply. Good. Terrific. That already knocks out the professor of Talmud. All he wants is his paycheck. And maybe to publish a paper or two. He doesn't want to do it for its own sake. Doesn't believe in anything for its own sake. So, the Talmud statement doesn't give any promises to him. And that counterexample drops off. But still, why should I accept this as consistent with what we know of human nature? But let's analyze a little more carefully the picture that Rousseau Salant is giving us. What's this guy's condition? I really should get up to daven with the minyan in the morning. At 7 o'clock in the morning. I really should do that because I know it's a mitzvah. And I want to do it lishma. I want to do it because it's a mitzvah. Because God wants me to do it. Nevertheless, when the alarm clock rings, I am expert in a state of 90% sleep at finding the snooze button, and bang, down goes the snooze button, and I hear it in a half hour later. And another half hour later. Now, so I'm lazy. And when the moment of decision comes, my laziness overcomes, or I allow my laziness to overcome. I'm not begging questions about free will today. And I sleep on. Do I want to get up for minyan? Yes, I definitely do. That's why I set the alarm. If I didn't want to get up for minyan, I wouldn't set the alarm. And I wouldn't have that inner sense of failure when I hit the snooze button. I definitely want to get up. But I also want to sleep. I have contradictory desires, which is very often the case in life. In fact, John Searle has convinced me that it's, I would say, universal in life to have contradictory desires. I want the food, but I don't want to give up my money, do I? I just choose which one I want more. Or I choose which one I'm going to act on. Okay, so do I want to get up? I mean, do I want to do the mitzvah lishma? Yeah, I definitely do. But I also want to sleep, and usually, if not always, I decide to sleep. So what do? I add a shalom lishma motivation. I add it. It's not that the shalom lishma is working on its own. It's working in addition. I add it. Here's a suggestion that I have for this particular problem. Or schedule a chavrusa for 10 minutes before davening begins. I said davening begins at 7:30. If I go straight to davening, I get up at 7 o'clock. I schedule a chavrusa for 7:20. Now, the alarm is ringing at 10 to 7. That's even worse. The alarm rings at 10 to 7, and I'm groping for the snooze button, and I think to myself, wait a minute. He's going to be there at 7:20. He's getting up now to meet me there. Is it fair that he should get up and lose his sleep to meet me, and I won't be there? What kind of a rat am I? What kind of a bum am I? Then I'm going to make an agreement with him, and he's going to get up, and I'm not going to get up. So I drag myself out of bed. Now, time to think carefully. Why am I getting out of bed? What's getting me out of bed? The embarrassment, the fear of embarrassment, of not being there and having to face him later and have to admit that I didn't get out of bed. And my desire to do the mitzvah. There are two things working together to get me out of bed. Because my desire to do the mitzvah is where I started from. I have a desire to do the mitzvah. A desire to do the mitzvah for its own sake. I have that desire. It's just that, usually in the morning, faced with laziness and feeling tired, I choose to stay in bed. So I've added a shalom lishma motivation. Now there are two of them. The two of them together, the lishma, doing the mitzvah for its own sake, plus the shelo lishma to avoid the embarrassment. The two of them together are enough to get me over the hump. That's the picture. That's the picture, according to the Salanta, of the Gemara's guarantee. The guarantee is, if you're a person who wants to do the mitzvah lishma, but because of opposing desires, you typically choose against it. And you add on another desire to do the mitzvah, shelo lishma, and that brings you to do it. It's enough. You put in enough shelo lishma that together with the lishma, you're able to do it. Then the Gemara guarantees that you will outgrow the need for the shelo lishma, the selfish motivation, and you'll come to do it for the motivation of doing the mitzvah for itself, all by itself. Now, I haven't explained this yet. I haven't given the explanation. I've just eliminated the one objection of the professor. But I haven't explained why that should be. Why should that be? Okay, so my motivation to do it for its own sake isn't enough. Usually I choose to snooze. And now I've added in the embarrassment. Oh, now the embarrassment plus the desire to do the mitzvah for its own sake gets me up. It gets me up a week, a month, a year. Why should I think that eventually I'll outgrow the need for the extra crutch? Okay, it's an extra crutch. But why should I think I'll outgrow the need for that? Now, this, I think, I came to understand a fair time ago, some years ago. Let's take an example. We take a child, a Jewish child, with Jewish parents, poor kid. And he's going to play the violin, he is, because he has Jewish parents. So he will learn to play the violin. Well, the child has his own plans for playing ball, you know, and listening to music. Nothing we're doing. The kid's going to practice the violin. He doesn't want to. So, being good Jewish parents, I use a combination of threats and promises. If you don't practice today, I'll beat you to within an inch of your life. Or if you practice today and tomorrow, I'll give you $1,000. You know, we just little incentives one way or another. And we get the kid to do it. Now, what happens, typically, not always, but typically, is that you need these blandishments for a year maybe, or 18 months. After that, the child starts practicing on his own. And indeed, you could skip the incentives, positive or negative, and the child will continue to practice. Why didn't he become dependent on the payoff? How did he manage to graduate to doing this terrible chore without the payoff? In the case of the violin, I think the answer is simple. When a child first plays the violin, all he produces is noise. You know it's noise. He knows it's noise. He knows that you know it's noise. It's awful. It's really awful. Why should he keep up making noise? What's the incentive in it? He doesn't enjoy it. You don't enjoy it. You both know that each other is not enjoying it. That's good for a year and a half. After a while, it starts to make music. And if he's a child with normal sensitivities, the music itself is beautiful. And the appreciation that he can make music on his own, that's a beautiful thing. I speak as a musician. Well, I play the flute and I play the violin, but I'm still a musician for many, many years. I perform hundreds of times. And the fact that you can make music, I mean, it's a wonderful, beautiful thing. It becomes self-motivating. You don't need a motivation from the outside. You don't need a payoff or a threat. The music sings inside you. And the thrill that you produce that music. And you get to the point where you have tastes in how music should be played, so you play it your way, the way it should really be played. So here's the picture. The picture is that inside the person, there's an element that naturally responds to music in general, and even more so the music that he produces. The trouble is his initial state when he's not producing music. He's producing noise. To get over the initial stage, you need an external motivation. But when it gets to the point where the production is music, you can drop the external motivation, because the thrill and the enjoyment of the activity itself will carry the person. You'll have children someday, and you'll notice a very peculiar thing with very little children. They struggle to do something new. They are endlessly fascinated by doing new things. And often it takes them a while to master it. When they master it, they can do it 1,000 times in a row. Over and over and over again. Today, tomorrow, next day, next week. The same thing over and over and over again. It's the thrill of mastery. I can do it. I've got it. It's mine. I own it. It's under my control. You see the joy on their faces. You see the energy in their movements. And you say, but it's the same old thing. No, but he's enjoying the mastery that he can do it. Now, I think the message of the statement of the Talmud is this. That the Torah, the mitzvos of the Torah, and the soul are created by the same creator. And they are designed for one another. They're designed to fit one another. The person who does a mitzvah, there's a natural resonance in the soul to the performance of the mitzvah. Only, initially, it isn't that way. Because initially the person knows very well that he's clumsy, that he's not doing it with mastery, he doesn't feel comfortable with what he's doing. And even if he learns how to do it physically, but he doesn't understand what he's doing, so his mind isn't online, his feelings aren't online, it's very mechanical. It's sort of like trying to get a tone-deaf child to play the violin. That's not going to thrill him. And you'll always have to use punishments and gifts in order to get him to keep doing it. But the person whose soul is not tone-deaf, when he gets fluidity in the performance, and when he understands what the performance is about, and he integrates those two, there's a natural resonance in the soul which leads the person to appreciate what he's doing. And then the Talmud says, he can graduate to the point where he doesn't need it. Now, go back to what Rosh Hashanah said. A symptom of this is that the person knows and wants to do it because God commanded him to do so. That much identification he has at the outset. It said that there are opposing forces. There are opposing forces. When he regularly acts correctly, when he has the satisfaction of doing what God wants him to do, which he already wants to do, that satisfaction strengthens his attachment to the mitzvah. And then, as I said, it awakens that natural response of the soul, and therefore, in all normal cases, it can be expected that eventually he won't need the external payoff anymore, and he'll come to be able to do it on his own. Now, if this is something like the right explanation, then the picture we're getting is that it is natural for the person to be active. It's not natural to be passive. It's natural to be active. The mitzvos of the Torah are what it is naturally fulfilling to do. And we should expect that a person who does not perform these actions will be naturally frustrated. Because that element in him that is tuned to resonate to the stimulus of the performance of the mitzvah, that element in him is not functioning. So that the picture here we're getting is a picture of a person who is created for action. That's point number one. Everybody with me? Yeah.
So that's the question. I thought that isn't there like that mitzvahs are created against our natural inclination? So, like, we're not bound by positive karma, mitzvahs, the body's already bound by time. So I can add examples. So why would it be that we have a natural resonance for mitzvahs? Isn't it that we go against our natural inclination despite that to do the mitzvahs?
Okay, the problem here, and this is absolutely crucial for thinking about this and thinking about many other issues, your desires, your motivations, your emotions are not under a bound of consistency. You are setting up an either-or situation. Either you have a natural inclination to do, or you have a natural inclination not to do. The truth is, you have both, of course. Otherwise, you wouldn't have free will. That's why you have a good inclination and a bad inclination, but we forget that. Of course, you have both. I'm only pointing out that you have a natural resonance on the positive side. That's and then, that's what gets awakened, and then that can carry it. So what you have, the initial picture is the desire to do it for its own sake, plus embarrassment, getting me out of bed to go to Minyan. Now that second element of the embarrassment getting me out can be replaced by the natural resonance once the natural resonance is achieved. That's the idea. Yeah.
There has to be a certain proportion between the reinforcing behavior and the actual bits that you want to do. Or can you have any proportion of that? Like, you have to want to do the bits some more, and then just like a bit on the side, you have like you'll feel honor.
I don't know. I never saw any quantifying of the point that it's this much or that much. I mean, hard to be put numbers on it. I'm not aware of any such quantity. I assume that in a religious person, a person believes in God, and believes the Torah is given at Sinai, and that this is the key to the perfection of himself and the world, will have a not small desire to do it. Just as there are other desires that are very powerful and very difficult to overcome, like pride or like laziness or like physical pleasures or who knows what.
I know some people, for example, who learn Gemara, and I'm not infused them, but they do understand that they're always hoping that maybe they'll find something. But they're not doing it for a good reason.
But these are not people who want to do it for its own sake. To want to do it for its own sake, one has to recognize that there is a God, the God who commanded it, and you understand your obligation to serve him, just that sometimes it's hard. Right? Here, it sounds more to me, what you're describing is a person who has a lackluster life, and is looking for something to inspire him. But if it would be a guru coming through town who would preach, that's unbelievable, some Christian cleric, some Christian devotee, sat on a little platform at the top of a flagpole for 30 some odd years. He sat there for over 30 years on a little wooden, something or other. I mean, he's looking for inspiration. He's got a flat life, and if it isn't this, it'll be something else. That's not what I call a person who wants to do it this well. Yeah.
With the example of the child playing with violence, you said you were saying how eventually, at the beginning, he can't really make music, and once he can make music, that's part of the inspiration because he sees the beauty. What would you say the music is? What music can we consider?
So what's the motivation from doing this to God as opposed to just doing it for yourself? Where is it? Motivation
for
his money or hearing the sound?
Well, no. I mean, I'm not sure you're asking the question exactly what he means. Look, I think that you should turn the question on its head. So, what if it's well-tuned sounds? Where's the music inside? I know what the music inside is, but where's the corresponding thing for the actions that this is just series of pitches and timbres in sound. Right? So I don't know if we have a great explanation. In fact, I do know that we don't have a great explanation. One of the courses they forced me to take in graduate school was aesthetics. And I discovered that nobody knows anything about aesthetics. It's all useless fluff. And as entrancing as all sounds, you can find something that's the exact opposite with the same entrancing vocabulary, and none of it means anything. I don't know if we understand what chord in the person's spirit music touches, and those parts that are similar from culture to culture, those parts that are different from culture to culture. I don't know if we have any real explanation for that. There are certain things that touch people. Complicated coordinations in athletics. Why am I thrilled when a person does three vertical flips and a twist and lands on two hands? I don't know if anybody really understands all those things and poetry and art and beautiful scientific creations. And those people who tell you that a mathematical proof could be beautiful, which sounds like gobbledygook. Math is the most difficult drudgery, just pushing those symbols around. And yet, there can be mathematical proofs that are beautiful. I don't know if anybody understands it. It's just a part of human nature to be drawn naturally by certain types of experiences. And they have their own natural reinforcement. Only, they require certain competency for that reinforcement to be triggered. I'm using music as an example of a fact. I don't have an explanation for it. I don't know if we would have any greater explanation for the feeling of mastering a blot of Gemara, or putting on tefillin to serve your Creator, or davening at the Kosel, or the other things that take place. I don't know if we have any of you competent explanations of these things. And the word competent is important. Anybody can make up an explanation. But you know, 100 people will make up 100 different explanations, and they'll all be equally nonsense. Yeah?
The whole resonation of the soul idea, understood by saying that it can overpower, it's like a separate entity that can overpower the emotions, so that in other words, it can counteract the emotions, the negative emotions, toward driving us away from doing the mitzvah.
I think that you shouldn't, you're probably right, but I'm afraid of the vocabulary. This resonance involves the emotions. It co-opts the emotions. It's not something sui generis which opposes everything else. No, it's a way of organizing everything else and bringing everything else online in a particular direction. So it uses certain emotions. It brings certain emotions into the performance that wouldn't have been there before. All right, next. Pride. I suppose pride, in the simplest sense, is feeling that I have something important, valuable, and then that makes me better than other people. I think those two elements are what's common to pride. It's not enough. If I have something very valuable, which everybody else has, then I'm very unlikely to feel proud. You know, I have, with my glasses on, I have 20/20 vision. So what? Everybody else has 20/20 vision with their glasses on. Now, if I had it without my glasses on at my age, then I could be proud. Now, people are much prouder of things they do for themselves than things they merely possess. I've met people who think that for something you really possess, pride isn't appropriate at all. I don't know. I'm not convinced. But take two people. I know people who, no matter how much they eat and what they eat, they stay thin. That's not me. No. I have to watch what I eat, and I have to exercise. I have to be careful. Now, I think a person who produces his health, his right weight, height, ratio through diet and exercise will be much prouder of his health than a person who just happens to have lucky genes where he is healthy automatically because he produced it for himself. In England, for the last 5 or more years, they've been researching what's called the Churchill syndrome. Winston Churchill was dreadfully overweight, never exercised, smoked big flats, cigars, and drank too much, and lived with quite good health until his 90s. He did everything wrong and got away with it. Well, they'd like to know how that works. First of all, to identify the people who have it, so they can sell them lots of cigars. And second of all, maybe it would inject everybody else with it so that it'll sell even more cigars. Those are the people who are paid for the research, I think. The whiskey people, the cigar people. And the health clubs are trying to shoot the people doing the research because they want the people to go to the health clubs. That's economics. So now, I don't think that Churchill could be proud of his health at all. Well, maybe there's room somehow, but it's certainly not the same as a person who produces it for himself. Here, if pride is my feeling of my success, my feeling of worth, my feeling of value, and compare it to other people, the very fact that the pride is very largely dependent upon my producing it for myself means that I see myself naturally as active. I define myself as active. And therefore, what I look for is a recognition of my active accomplishments. And that's much more meaningful to me than things which I happen to have by nature or by gift. A person who made a million is quite different. Feels quite differently about his money than a person who inherited a million. Because he made it for himself. The same thing's true with the effort. The harder the challenge was to produce it for yourself, the more satisfaction you have in the achievement. Now, why should that be? Okay, I produced it for myself, and I'm naturally active, and I want things to be done that I did, but why should I glory in the fact that it was hard? Why should it be just as appreciated by me, and I should be just as proud of it, if it was easy? It's in the effort of the action that I see a major element of my worth. The fact that I accomplished something by using all of my strength, my ability, my energy, helps to define what I feel I'm worthy of, what I've done that's worthwhile. And that, again, is an indication of the fact that we see ourselves as naturally active. But these reflections, I think, are... I've not heard them anywhere. They're things that occur to me in thinking about this subject, and I think they're not sufficiently appreciated. Now, there's another dimension to this activity. Where is the activity taking place? What kinds of effects is it supposed to have? Where does the pride lie? Let's imagine a person who has invented a machine, the dream machine. This is science fiction. You plug in the electrodes of this machine into your brain, and he programs the computer, and it causes you to have dreams. Any dreams you want. Climbing Mount Everest in a bathing suit, or swimming the English Channel underwater holding your breath, or multiplying 200 digit primes in your head, getting 6 zillion answers. I don't know. Whatever you want. And it's free to connect you up and cause you to have these dreams free of charge. There's only one catch. When they connect you up to the dream machine, they also connect you up to a life support system, and you remain connected for the rest of your life. You never get off. Now the question is, would you take it? You tell them what dreams you want, and they'll program it for the rest of your life to have the dreams that you want. Clearly, in the dream, you will have more pleasure, more fun, more satisfaction, more thrill, more inspiration than you're going to get in the real world. Because the real world has dead ends and disappointments and inefficiencies and so on. So you're clearly going to get more in the dream machine than you will in the real world. Still, when I have asked groups of people about this, most people say they would not take the dream machine. Okay, so it'll be a puzzle why they say that. What about the minority, those who say they would? So for them, I have a subsidiary question. Let's imagine, this is science fiction, remember? Let's imagine that you have been examined by a team of brain scientists, and they know that you can cure cancer. And you want to do that, desperately. You're dying to cure cancer. And the government has put unlimited funds and unlimited research materials at your disposal, and they're predicting that in 30 years you're going to crack it and cure cancer. So it's established next month. You're going to take up your position and start the research. Now along comes the guy with the dream machine. He says, I've read about you in the paper, and I know what you're setting out to do. Setting out to cure cancer. I offer you. I'll program the dream machine to cause you to dream that you cure cancer. The same thing. 30 years. Research. Funds, the whole business. I'll just program it to do in the dream what you're going to do in the real world. So here, the pleasure, the satisfaction, the thrill, the inspiration of the real world and the dream will be the same. Now I ask, how do you choose? Do you flip a coin? I don't think anybody would flip a coin. Why? Because here, if you do it in the real world, real people's lives will be saved. Whereas you do it in the dream, no one is going to be helped. So if it's nothing to you, if it doesn't affect your pleasures at all, then I think everyone will say, I'd rather do it in the real world, where I can help people. Yes, to give up my hope for pleasure and satisfaction and thrill and inspiration for the sake of helping others, I'm not prepared to do that. But if I don't have to give anything up, then surely I want to help other people. What these examples show is that everyone has some desire to have an effect on the real world. Some desire. I don't say it's a person's only desire. I don't say it's his most important desire. He has lots of desires. Some of his desires are for his own pleasure. And when there's a conflict, he may choose his own pleasure. But he has some desire to affect the real world. So that if I create a case, like I did with the second tree machine, if I create a case where his own pleasure isn't a factor, then of course he wants to help other people. Now, again, we should wonder why this is. It seems that we have a natural external orientation. It's not the whole of our orientation. We care about ourselves as well. But part of us is oriented externally and cares about the effects that we have on the world around us. Here, the idea is not only that we're naturally active, that we're naturally doing things, but we are naturally concerned with having an effect on the world around us, not just an effect on ourselves. Now, where does this come from? I don't know what secular psychologists would say, or what second philosophy. I haven't seen anybody discuss things in these terms at all, but I don't know what they would say if they were asked. But from us, the root of this is very deep. God created the world. That's not simple. God didn't rest in infinite stasis, infinite placidity, content unto himself, self-sufficient, self-contained, and remain that way for eternity. No, he created a world. That means there's something, there is something essentially active about God. However you explain it, on whatever level you trace it, there's something essentially active about God. I have found it always peculiar. People who are adherents of certain religions that believe in God, gods who are responsible for our world, and who preach that the highest thing for them to do as people who believe in this religion is to repair to a cave someplace and meditate. That the world is too distracting to achieve contact with your inner self, and that the only way to do is cut it out as much as possible and to go off and meditate. What I find peculiar about this point of view is that these people in this religion are doing the exact opposite of what their gods are doing. Their gods are creating flowers and mosquitoes and thunderstorms and the seas and so forth and so on. And they're retreating from all that to get away from it so as to... If meditating is so terrific, why isn't their god meditating and they don't exist? I don't see how the thought system fits together. That's their problem, to break out their own religion. In our case, God created. If God created, and if we are related to Him, if we are similar to Him, if our soul is a piece of God on high, then we should expect that we are naturally active. Because He is naturally active. And we are a reflection of Him. For us, this is a natural expectation, a natural part of our philosophy. And what is he doing? He's doing chesed. He's benefiting. He's creating the world in order to do good. And to do good means to produce good in a recipient. And that's why we exist. We exist as a recipient to whom he's doing good. So his actions are focused on an other to produce an effect on the other. if we are created in his reflection, it's quite reasonable that we should have a natural external orientation, that we too should feel drawn to produce an effect in the world around us. So from our understanding of where the soul comes from, this is a natural expectation. And then these symptoms of activity, which I have described for you, these symptoms to us become a very natural part of what the human being is. Really so far? Okay. Now, however, we do have to explain why it is that we have selfish desires. Why do we have any selfish desires at all? Why are we focused inward at all? If we are similar to God, if the soul is a reflection of God, God doesn't have any inner desires, any motivation to benefit himself. His motivation is wholly altruistic. Our motivation is not that. More or less, but it is not that way. Why do we have built-in selfish desires? Here, I think the answer is this. I'm just working out an answer on my own. I think the answer is this. For us, free will... I'll clarify and say, let me say it in a formula, and then I'll clarify. For us, free will is what enables us to be godlike. Free will is what enables us to be godlike. Not because God has free will. No. That's not why. It's not that we have free will and he has free will, so therefore we're godlike because we both have that. No, that's not true. Free will enables us to be godlike even though he doesn't have it. Because free will produces for us a certain result, and God has that result, but in a different way. And what we're similar in is the result, not in the way the result is produced. So, free will enables us to achieve things for ourselves, by ourselves, to some extent. A human being who makes his own choices. Let's go back to the diet. So, I'm thin. I'm thin because I made my choices. So, I made my thinity. My thinness. And I'm thin because of my choices, so it's my accomplishment. It's a reflection of me. It's self-determined. My thinness is determined by myself. Now, whatever God is, he is because of himself. God is totally independent, totally self-contained, totally self-determined. Nothing makes God, nothing changes God, nothing affects God, nothing acts on God. Not by free will, but because of his very nature. His very nature is totally self-contained. Okay. So, his totally self-contained nature means he's self-determined. My exercise of free will means that I'm self-determined. The bottom line is that we're both self-determined. In that, we're similar. We don't get there in the same way. He gets there by his very nature. I get there by my exercise of free will. But what I get, namely being in part self-determined, is similar to what he gets, namely being self-determined. So, in order for me to get that similarity to God, I have to be dissimilar for the means to get it. And getting the bottom line of being self-determined is more important than differing vis-a-vis the means. So, free will is crucial in order to achieve that bottom line of being self-determined. And free will depends upon opposing motivations. You're only free when you have motivations opposing one another, with a clash, and then free will can make the decision. If your motivations are only one-sided, then there's no free will at all. That's why there have to be selfish desires. The selfish desires are unlike God. And the very existence of free will is unlike God. But the accomplishment, having the selfish desires, makes free will possible. The exercise of free will makes me able to be self-determined. And then I share that element with God, being self-determined. So the selfish desires indeed are a disanalogy with God, but they are crucial for that accomplishment. Now, according to what I've told you, this is the last point. According to what I've told you, the highest satisfaction ought to be, maybe someone can say, what ought to give the person the highest possible satisfaction? Freely,
Freely deciding to be like God, to be God-like.
No, so not to build himself? No, is that what God is doing?
To be self-determined.
Self-determined in what?
Objections.
Any old actions? Jumping through hoops, you know?
No, the actions that God told you to do.
All right, but why not? Before he told me to do anything, what actions should I be doing? His actions, right? Doing his actions. And that, indeed, is what gives people an enormous amount of satisfaction. It's the foundation of love. To know that somebody needs me, to know that I can help somebody, to know that somebody depends upon me. Everyone needs to be needed, they used to say in English. It's one of the deepest needs that a person has. A person who's unneeded is usually a person who goes to rot. Why is it such a crisis when people finally retire from their jobs? Because nobody needs them. They don't count for anything. And there's just so many rounds of golf that you can play. There's just so many ping pong games you can play. Just so many computer games you can play. Just so many movies you can see. If nobody needs you, then you cease to take yourself seriously. You cease to take your life seriously. Things start to go to pieces. That's why it is so crucial for older people to have something to do. Something that's really important. I've counseled people who retire. Volunteer in the schools. If you have any kind of educational background, volunteer in the schools. They'll love you for it. The kids will enjoy it. And you'll help them with math, with science, with English composition, whatever it is, with history. Volunteer in hospitals. Teach other people to do the job that you did for 40 years and you know backwards and forwards. Help train people for that job. For money, without money. People will come to depend upon you. And because they depend upon you, you have a reason to exist. You have a reason to live. A reason to live that people depend upon you. Because it is ingrained in the neshama, in the soul. This is Rav Kessler's Kunshus HaChesed, his Essay on Loving Kindness. This spontaneous gesture of giving to others and the need to feel that others appreciate and depend upon what I have to give them, that is an inherent, deep-seated need of a human being. And then when he does that, that's the springboard for his natural activity. And the deepest natural activity is the natural activity in which he imitates God. Okay.